Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Brett Atkins of the group Stand Up America, who discusses Trump's success in eliminating checks on his unrestrained executive power and the urgent need to enact new guardrails to defend against a future Trump-like dictatorship. Hilda Bonilla, an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, who explains why the Trump regime's attempt to deport dozens of Guatemalan children in the middle of the night should shock the conscience of every American. And Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former CIA analyst, who assesses the consequences of Donald Trump's foreign policy that has dangerously alienated both adversaries and allies alike. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Talks on a global plastic pollution treaty collapsed in mid-August as oil-producing nations blocked the ratification of a strong treaty. The binding treaty would have put limits on plastic pollution and restricted the use of harmful chemicals. The fossil fuel industry opposed the limits on plastics, which are made from petrochemicals. Inger Anderson of the United Nations Environmental Program and convener of the Geneva Treaty negotiations observed it was time for nations to regroup after failing to reach consensus on the treaty text. A growing number of environmental groups denounced the consensus process as blocking strong international action on plastics. Negotiations on the treaty began in 2022 after nations agreed to reach a strong legally binding agreement that would restrict the rapid growth of global plastics pollution. Failure of the talks means that island-sized rafts of rotting plastic in the world's oceans will keep endangering marine and human health. In December, discussions on regulating plastics will continue at the UN Environment Assembly in Kenya, providing a chance for further negotiations on the plastics treaty. The Russian-backed mercenary Wagner Group is floundering in West Africa 2 years after its founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was killed in a suspicious plane crash after leading a brief revolt against the Kremlin. The Russian force has backed Mali's government, which took control after a 2021 coup against an Islamist insurgency. But The Economist reports Wagner's brutal tactics, racism, and defiance of government commands has angered many in Mali's army. Mali's interim leader, Assimi Goïta, was widely supported for expelling the French military from the country and welcoming in the Russians to battle jihadist fighters. Although Russian forces helped recapture the northern city of Kidal, the jihadists have proved to be an elusive foe. Nearly 2,000 people have been killed in renewed fighting this year, and 80% of civilian deaths were carried out by Malian soldiers or Wagner mercenaries. Thus far, Wagner has failed to take over Mali's gold mines, as it has in other African nations. Some observers suggest that Goïta may be seeking to swap Russian support for American help, as the Trump administration is actively offering to discuss the potential for security assistance in exchange for mineral deals. The Trump administration is escalating its attack on activists protesting against Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Prosecutors in Spokane, Washington, filed a conspiracy charge against U.S.-Afghan war veteran Baji Mavalwala, who participated in a June protest to block an ICE transport of two Venezuelan immigrants who were in the U.S. legally, petitioning for asylum when they were detained. A month after the protest, Mavalwala was charged with conspiracy to impede and injure officers. The charge carries a maximum penalty of 6 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Mavalwala has no criminal record and won praise for finding safe houses for Afghans fleeing Kabul on the eve of the capital city's fall to the Taliban in 2021. acting U.S. Attorney Pete Serrano, who brought the charges, was nominated by Donald Trump for the permanent post. Serrano is a former litigator for the Silent Majority Foundation, a conservative advocacy group that filed an amicus brief in support of Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship guaranteed by the Constitution's 14th Amendment. Robert Chang, a law professor at the University of California in Irvine, said, "Charges against Mavalwala appear to be selective prosecution and will lead to a chilling effect on free speech under the First Amendment." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Over the past 7 months, Americans have witnessed Donald Trump's unprecedented attacks against democratic institutions, the Constitution, and the rule of law. This extremist regime is clearly executing an authoritarian or fascist agenda to remove all checks and balances on executive power with the intention of imposing a dictatorship personified in Trump's cult of personality. After Trump deployed the military to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., he's threatened to target Chicago, Baltimore, New Orleans, and other minority-majority cities. The military occupation of U.S. cities, a clear violation of the Constitution's Posse Comitatus Act, comes as masked ICE agents, acting as Trump's personal secret police force, abduct and brutalize non-citizens and citizens alike without due process. All this while the extremist fascist-friendly majority of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court rubber-stamped Trump's authoritarian rule. Your reporter spoke with Brett Edkins, Managing Director of Policy and Political Affairs with Stand Up America, who discusses Trump's success in dismantling checks and balances on his exercise of unrestrained executive power and the urgent need to enact new guardrails to defend against a future Trump-like dictatorship.
We are witnessing a sustained ongoing assault on the rule of law and on democracy itself. I think we have to call a spade a spade. This is what it looks like when a democracy descends into authoritarianism. We're not there yet. A lot of our institutions and our people are fighting back. But this is what it looks like when democracy and the rule of law are under threat. Donald Trump is guilty of so many unconstitutional and unlawful actions that it's staggering. He refuses to spend money appropriated by Congress, which is Congress's power. He has removed heads of independent agencies who are protected by law from summary firings. He's fired civil servants without cause, including January 6 prosecutors who put violent criminals who attacked the Capitol in jail. He's dismantled federal agencies without any legal basis for doing so. And he's called up the National Guard on very thin pretexts to terrorize U.S. citizens, stop and arrest citizens and lawful residents without due process. He sent ICE agents with masks without badges or identification to raid businesses and communities across the country. He's investigating political enemies. He's threatening the broadcast licenses of institutions like ABC and NBC in violation of the First Amendment. He's siphoning billions of dollars to his family businesses. You know, Forbes estimates that Trump's worth has more than doubled to more than $5 billion over just the past year. Qatar is sending him luxury jets. The Saudis, the Qataris, the Emirates, they're investing in Trump businesses. India, Vietnam, and Qatar are planning to build Trump golf courses, all in a fairly desperate and transparent attempt to bribe Donald Trump and his administration. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court, three of the justices were appointed by him, and the other three conservatives are aligned with him, are continually enabling this assault on our democracy and the rule of law. Rather than strike down the blatantly unconstitutional order to deprive Americans of birthright citizenship as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Supreme Court condemned the district judges for doing their job. Didn't condemn Trump, went after their own judges and their own Article III branch of government who were stopping the assault on our rights. The Supreme Court blessed Donald Trump's use of ICE to stop people at random in LA for being Latino. The guidance to ICE is to stop people who speak Spanish, who look Latino, who are working in low-wage jobs, and detain them. Now, that is a fairly clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. And in an emergency ruling with barely any explanation, the Supreme Court said, go ahead. So we have to be alarmed. We should be alarmed. It just doesn't mean that we have to give up.
Well said, Brett. I'd like you to comment on the urgency of strengthening the guardrails of democracy if the Republicans do lose power in 26 or 28, because it seems like this may be the last opportunity to protect democratic institutions from a president and a political party that seems hell-bent on destroying democracy.
I agree with you. The next opportunity to pass a pro-democracy agenda has to be seized quickly. There was a chance early in the Biden administration to pass sweeping democracy reform, and that effort passed the House. It had every Democrat in the Senate for it, but it couldn't get past the filibuster. There was an opportunity in the early Biden administration to get rid of partisan gerrymandering. But if there is another opportunity to strengthen, reform our democracy, and throw out the status quo that has not been working for people for decades, then it has to be seized, and it has to include Supreme Court reform. The Supreme Court has been bought and paid for by far-right interest groups, corporations, Federalist Society, Donald Trump and his allies. They are siding with him time and time again in an extremely political manner, usually through speedy emergency opinions that are barely opinions at all. It's like a one-sentence thing. The lower courts are kind of surprisingly speaking out for the first time ever this week. You heard district court judges speaking off the record about how alarmed they are by the Supreme Court abandoning them and issuing decisions in an emergency docket way. And that means we need real ethics reform, binding code of ethics in the Supreme Court. It means we need term limits, and we may need to think about expanding the number of justices on the court to restore some semblance of balance, because this court is more out of whack with where the American people are than any time in living memory. It also means not just ending partisan gerrymandering, but getting money out of politics. It means reducing the powers of the presidency that Trump is exploiting day in and day out, some of these loopholes that he's finding in the National Guard and allowing the military to be used on our streets, endless national emergencies where he can bomb a Venezuelan boat or other places under an emergency power that Congress has no check on, that he can't stop spending money that Congress appropriated, because that is Congress's power. So it has to be comprehensive. And if we let that opportunity go by again, we could be right back here where we're having the same kinds of conversations because some unscrupulous politicians of either political party are exploiting the legal loopholes to pursue an unlawful, unconstitutional agenda and getting barely any pushback from the courts and institutions that are meant to protect our rights.
That was Brett Edkins, Managing Director of Policy and Political Affairs with Stand Up America. Learn more about the group and the National Not Above the Law Coalition by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the early hours of August 31st, ICE agents and contractors woke up dozens of Guatemalan children from the shelters and put them on buses headed to an airport in Texas. Most of the children were put on planes to be flown back to Guatemala, from which they had come to the U.S., unaccompanied by parents or other adults. The National Immigration Law Center filed a class action lawsuit against Kristi Noem, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and many other members of Donald Trump's government, to keep the children in the U.S. The 10 child plaintiffs named in the class action lawsuit, with their initials only, ranged in age from 10 to 17 years old. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hilda Bonilla, an attorney and legal fellow with the National Immigration Law Center, who describes the drama that unfolded on the airport tarmac as the Department of Homeland Security attempted to deport these Guatemalan children out of the U.S.
What happened this weekend with Guatemalan children should truly shock the conscience of all Americans, because vulnerable kids were woken up in the middle of the night to be removed to a country where they may face abuse, neglect, persecution. NILC started to hear reports about the administration's plans on Friday, August 29. And we immediately got into action trying to draft legal papers to try to stop the removals from happening. In the middle of the night, on Saturday, August 30th, we started hearing reports that kids were being transferred to airports and put on planes to be removed. So we filed a complaint at 1 in the morning. And after that, we filed a temporary restraining order at about maybe 1:30 that ended up being granted at 4:22 a.m.
Now, the Trump administration is saying that all they wanted to do was family reunification. They wanted to send these kids back to be with their families. Apparently, there were some families who were prepared to accept them or wanted them back. I don't really know, but from reports I heard, they were at least meeting the planes at the airport and were going to welcome them back. What do you know about that?
We have a few declarations in which either parents saying that they didn't request for their children to be removed from the United States, and we have some other statements in the children's declarations saying that their parents were surprised to hear that they were being removed. In addition to that, I mean, some of the children have pending immigration cases, pending asylum claims. We have a few, or at least one, that was granted special immigrant juvenile status, which basically means that according to United States decided that it was not safe for them to go back to their home country.
In these cases, were there also children who were sort of fleeing their own families because of abuse? Is that part of the story here?
Yes, yes. There were children that reported that, you know, they either had a deceased parent or that their parents were abusive towards them, that they had no one to go back to, and that they would definitely not be safe if they were returned to Guatemala.
Where are the children now? Where did they get returned to?
They are in the Office of Refugee Resettlement Custody, which is what is supposed to happen by law. They are in OAR shelters now. For right now, what is in place is the temporary restraining order that the judge granted at around noon on Sunday, August 31st. That temporary restraining order is in place until September 14. Right now, currently, we are briefing what is called a preliminary injunction, and the judge will have to issue a new ruling after the 14 days are up on that preliminary injunction and decide whether to extend the protection for the Guatemalan children or to modify it. I would just like to highlight the cruelty of pulling children out of their beds in the middle of the night. The attorneys also reported that the children were very confused and very scared, and that one girl was so scared that she started vomiting. So I think we just can't underestimate the trauma of what these children went through that night.
I was curious if NILC, the administration is trying to recruit hundreds, apparently, of military lawyers to, you know, help with this huge backlog of immigration cases, but they don't have to have, and in almost all cases don't have, any experience with immigration law. What do you think about that?
I think you flagged what the major concern is here, and that is that immigration law is notoriously complex. JAGs are likely to have very little to no background in immigration law, which raises serious concerns about how they'll make determinations in the life and death cases that will come before them. So totally, totally concerned about just how cases will be adjudicated.
That was Hilda Bonilla, an attorney and legal fellow with the National Immigration Law Center. Learn more about the legal fight against the Trump regime's targeting of immigrant children for deportation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just weeks after Donald Trump met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska to discuss the war in Ukraine, Putin traveled to Beijing, where he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were welcomed by China's President Xi Jinping to watch China's September 3rd military parade, marking 80 years since the end of World War II. Days earlier, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met with both Putin and Xi while attending the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, a not-so-subtle statement of defiance, just days after Trump doubled tariffs on longtime U.S. ally India to 50% as punishment for buying Russian oil. According to Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former CIA analyst, Trump's erratic and destructive foreign policy over the past 7 months has contributed to the historic strengthening of relations between Russia and China, as well as between Russia, China, India, and North Korea. At the same time, Trump has alienated and punished longtime U.S. allies in Europe, Canada, Latin America, and Asia with punitive tariffs, leaving the U.S. increasingly isolated on the world stage. Your reporter spoke with Goodman, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University and national security columnist for Counterpunch.org, who assesses the consequences of Trump's foreign policy and the recent lawless U.S. Navy attack on a boat off the coast of Venezuela that killed all 11 on board, accused without proof of being operated by the Tren de Aragua cartel and carrying drugs bound for the U.S.
We're taking steps that have driven China and Russia into the closest relationship they've ever had in history, in their very long history. And I'm not just talking about the joint military exercises and the generous exchanges of military intelligence and military weapons, but the fact that Putin and Xi Jinping have become very close. And we've played a role in that, in driving them into each other's arms. And then when you look at the recent meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was a Eurasian security group led by Moscow and Beijing, they brought into the fold Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and our relationship with Modi has really gone down the tubes. India is a very important country. Now Modi obviously is rushing to get on good terms with Xi Jinping. And then North Korea, which has had a very difficult relationship with China over the years, now has a very close relationship with Russia, very supportive of the Ukraine war, sending personnel, sending weaponry, and now improving relations with both Beijing and Moscow and giving North Korea access to more sophisticated military technology. And then finally, when you look at the founding countries of what's known as the BRICS group, that would be Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, now they're bringing in countries that used to have decent relations with the United States that are now moving away from the United States. That would be Egypt, Indonesia, Ethiopia, the United Arab Emirates. And you could say the same thing for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where countries like India, Turkey, Vietnam, and Egypt, all these bilateral relationships are suffering. And I think part of the problem is Trump is paying no attention whatever to these issues. We don't really have a functioning Secretary of State or a functioning National Security Advisor. So it's a deplorable situation. I don't see how it's going to improve with this cast of characters, because Trump can't maintain any discipline or attention to a problem over more than a 24-hour period. And anyone who's ever worked in arms control and disarmament, as I did with the SALT I and ABM agreements, know it takes years to negotiate these important agreements. And the last strategic agreement that we have left with Russia will expire in the next 5 or 6 months. I think it's February of 2026. Mm-hmm. So everywhere I look, I see the potential for further disaster, and a lot of it is self-inflicted wounds. We're doing this to ourselves. Trump is doing this to the United States.
Before we run out of time tonight, Mel, I did want to ask you about Trump's buildup of naval forces in the Caribbean off the coast of Venezuela and what many are labeling as an unconstitutional order to blow up a speedboat that was alleged to be part of the Tren de la Agua drug cartel that they said was smuggling drugs into the United States, although it was, I think, 1,500 miles away from the U.S. coastline, small outboard speedboat. And then, of course, you've got Pete Hegseth, Defense Secretary of the Pentagon, now renamed by Trump as the Department of War, stating that
The byword of the Pentagon now will be lethality, not tepid legality. So Department of War, lethality over legality, seems to be maybe a little truth in advertising.
Well, he's misusing the military at home, given what's happening in America's so-called sanctuary cities. And he's misusing the military abroad, given what happened on the high seas near Venezuela. There's a policy for dealing with drug running, and it's a policy that's usually carried out by the U.S. Coast Guard. Now you have the Navy deploying at least 8 major combatants in the region. There's a strategic submarine in the region. F-35s have been the latest to be deployed in the area, and you have all sorts of intelligence collectors. In the meantime, we've been given no real information about what was involved. No intelligence has been provided. We don't know what was on this ship. We don't know where they were headed. We don't know if anything of this is true. But we've committed now murder on the high seas. That's what we've done. We've engaged in an act of war on the open seas. Maduro, the Venezuelan president, has overflown some of these ships with his own aircraft, but he's obviously not going to take on the United States. We don't know where this policy is going. And whenever the intelligence community has introduced intelligence that takes issue with Trump's accusations about Venezuela and the terrorist group Tren de Aragua, they're removed from their positions. But clearly, this kind of extrajudicial killing, I don't know what else to call it, is an outrageous act. And I don't see a lot of protests from the international community. I'm sure they're stunned by it, but no one knows how to formulate a position that's critical of a United States action that violates international law.
That was Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a former CIA analyst, and national security columnist for Counterpunch.org. Find links to his recent columns and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, KCBP in Modesto, California, Global Community Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.